The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 10th of August, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Hanno Pengilly, Chief Development Officer of Nkondesi Energy, that's NCCL. And Hanno discusses an update to the shareholder loan agreement and other progress at the company. Plus, I also have on Brian McMaster, Executive Chairman of Harvest Minerals, and Brian discusses progress at the company of late. Also on the podcast, John Mayer, Mining Analyst with SP Angel, talking about Makango Resources, MKA, Blue Jay Mining, that's J Ticker, and Cora Gold. And Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, discusses the following stocks: Randgold Resources, that's RRS, Ibstock, IBST, and Cineworld. Plus, I also have the top five most liked RNSs on Vox Markets today.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Hanno Pengilly, Chief Development Officer at Nkondesi Energy, that's NCCL. Hanno, thanks for joining me.
Morning, Justin.
They got some news out today, and we'll cover that. It's a shareholder loan update, and we'll go into the detail of that. But as always, Hanno, there are people tuning in all the time. There are people not familiar with the company. So just to bring them up to speed, Nkondesi Energy, what's it all about, please?
So Nkondesi is a integrated coal mine and power plant project located in northern Mozambique, province of Tete, looking to develop a 300-megawatt power plant, and is currently negotiating a binding joint development agreement with General Electric and China Machinery Engineering Corporation to acquire 60% of the project and look to build and operate the plant.
Okay, so you've announced a shareholder loan update, and it's an update on the restructuring process on the loan you currently have. Could you take us through the significance of this, please, Hanno?
So, as we said before, I think in the last project update, there are a number of processes going in parallel, working in parallel. Mm-hmm. And one of those processes was the shareholder loan. The company currently has a shareholder loan that sits on the balance sheet of about $5.1 million. This was a loan that was originally taken out as a bridging facility to bridge a separate transaction 2 years ago with another potential strategic partner. And anyway, it just ended up sort of never being refinanced because we ended up negotiating a new deal with our current partners, General Electric and CMEC. And really, this announcement that's come out today has been an update for investors so that they're aware that there is a clear path and plan for the refinancing of this loan. We've said before that we've received a number of refinancing proposals on the loan. And if I'm honest, those proposals have sort of been changing over the last 12 months and generally changing for the better, in more attractive terms and sort of more flexibility. And basically, as we've explored those refinancing options, we've been very encouraged what we've been seeing. But unfortunately, as we've reviewed those proposals, it's become more and more clear that we would need to restructure the existing loan to provide us with the flexibility to refinance it in the future. And so what we've done here is we've put a proposal to the lenders, which we think is a very attractive proposal, both to the company, its investors, as well as to the lenders themselves. And it basically provides an extension of the loan, as well as there's a small coupon of 12% on the loan. I think the last coupon on the loan was 25%. So we've managed to, we're coming in with a much more aggressive coupon. And I think that's a reflection of, I think the de-risking that's happened in the business with the development with our partners. And we've also requested that the loan be convertible into equity at a price of about 10 pence, which is a premium of about 33% over yesterday's close. And I think sends a good, strong message to the market as to you know, again, where we believe what a fair value is for investors to convert. And the final piece here is that, you know, again, this is a loan that was structured as a bridge loan. And actually, the documentation that existed with that loan didn't give us the opportunity to actually pay down the loan at our election. It was only at maturity. So, you know, what we've done here is we put a proposal together that I think is attractive for lenders to give us the extension, but also provides Nkondezi with the flexibility to put a refinancing proposal forward as and when we have finalized one. We have spoken to most of the lenders to date with this proposal, and at the moment we've received in-principle support from over 60% of the lenders, which includes our chairman, Mike Howarth, and our non-executive directors, Chris Gutter and Dr. Esteban Pal. Now that the release is in the public domain, we will look to engage with the balance of lenders, which really is just our, you know, one of our larger lenders, which is the African Finance Corporation, which represents about 37% of the loan. We'll be engaging with them to get their support for this restructuring. And following that support, we will then finalize documentation and finalize the restructuring. We've got a clear strategy here. It's been very important for us to get this out into the market. The loan currently matures in the first week of September. So, you know, we believed it would be good to get ahead of the market and ensure that people were aware that there is a funding solution in place here, or a restructuring solution in place. And we're fairly confident we will get that across the line. And I think most importantly for everyone is that, you know, we are looking at positioning this loan in such a way that we can refinance it so that we can reduce the size of this loan on our balance sheet. And again, we have received a number of attractive offers that we will continue to work on post restructuring of the loan. And as regards to timetable, we would look to agree the restructuring package before the end of this month. And with the shareholders or approvals that will be required for the convertibility element of the loan, we're probably looking at having this all done and dusted before the end of September. So that's an overall, you know, that's an overview of what we're doing on the loan.
Yeah, but you know what? You're right there, Hanno. It does show the market almost the progress you're making there. And, you know, to be able to do this right now shows what a strengthened position you're in at the moment. You know, for people to accept that and to restructure the loan, that doesn't happen if the project's going the wrong way. It only happens when you're working towards a progress, doesn't it, really, this kind of restructuring?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you need to have something to be able to encourage your lenders to enter into sort of a restructuring of the loan. And again, I think the terms, you know, the terms that we've managed, you know, that we're proposing here and that have been accepted by most of the lenders, I think demonstrate that, you know, there has been a de-risking here of the loan, particularly compared to when we last extended the loan in September of last year. So, you know, overall, you know, I think a positive message from this. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the biggest issues from our side is that, you know, the focus for the company right now needs to be on the project development. The loan is almost, it's potentially an unnecessary distraction. So it's very important that we get on top of it. Again, we had hoped, if I'm brutally honest, we had hoped to refinance it earlier. But just the complexities of the loan, as well as sort of the varying terms of the refinancing options that we were getting, just meant that, unfortunately, we're going to need a little bit more time to do that. But, you know, as an interim step, I think the restructuring is a nice, attractive package. And it also gives investors sort of peace of mind that, you know, there is a plan for the loan, and, you know, it's an attractive plan.
Yeah, okay. And generally, like you say, it can sort of detract from what's actually happening there. And at the moment, progress-wise on the project, what is happening?
So at the moment, things are progressing as planned. We have meetings scheduled in the month of August. I think, you know, it's just a case of getting all the teams together. The materials are all prepared. And I think, you know, August is going to be a fairly busy month for us, working with the government of Mozambique, as well as the state-owned utility EDM, to finalize the process to move forward. So, you know, all looking good at this stage. And I guess all I can say that, you know, all I can say is that we will update the market, you know, at the right time when we have the information we need to provide. But all progressing well at this stage.
Excellent. Okay, Hannah, one final thing, you know, the back drill here. If someone's listening, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but is still not following the story as yet, give them those quick three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and therefore adding you to their watch list.
So Inkondesi is the most developed coal project in the region. We have completed our feasibility studies, our environmental studies. We've identified strategic partners who have the balance sheet and the expertise to finance and operate the project. We're also in the process of concluding a major deal with world-class partners, General Electric and CMEC, who will be looking to take a large equity stake in the project and manage it. And we have good news flow over the coming months as binding agreements and project development milestones are met. So, you know, there's news flow for people to get constant updates on how we're progressing.
Good work, Hannah. Look forward to chatting to you again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks again, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Brian McMaster, Executive Chairman of Harvest Minerals. HMI is the ticker there. Brian, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Justin.
And since we last talked, you've done a lot. You've had a lot of news out. And but before we get into some of that news and where you're headed next, Brian, for people who are, say, new to the podcast or not familiar with Harvest Minerals, could you just summarise what the business is about, please?
Yeah, sure. So Harvest is a name-listed business with operations in Brazil, and we are a fertiliser business. So effectively we have a organic fertiliser which is produced from surface and sold to the farmers in our local area down there. Brazil is one of the largest consumers of fertilisers on the planet, and it imports most of its fertiliser use. So we have, you know, a very highly demanded product right in the middle of an agricultural belt. Very, very simple operation. We just simply dig, crush and sell. So it's all pretty straightforward, really.
Yeah, and because of that, your margins are quite big, aren't they? So is it's kind of mine, I think, off memory, it's around about $7-8 is it costs, and you sell it for $60, is that right, a ton?
Yeah, in basic terms, that's right. I mean, we sell it sort of, you know, somewhere around about, you know, $60 US a ton, and it costs somewhere around about $8, so let's call it $10 for the sake of round numbers, $10 a ton to produce, so the margins are very healthy. You know, roughly $50 US a ton, sort of gross margin. So it's, you know, once you sort of hit your straps and you start, you know, selling some chunky amounts of product, you can see the cash flow generation is quite substantial.
Yeah. So where are you at the moment? I know you've RNS'd a couple of contracts where you're selling. So your sales have already started. You've got approval pretty much from the government there for the product. It's organic, it's obviously local, it's cheaper than sort of imports and stuff, so you know, very good position. Like you say, it's a massive market out there. So sales wise where are you up to at the moment, and where do you hope to go with it, the sales, Brian?
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, it's been a little while since I've spoken to you, Justin, and quite a lot's happened since then. You know, in sort of a headline sense, we some of the big ticket items this year that we'd been sweating on were getting our certification from the local government authorities down there, which we now have. And that's, you know, that was quite an arduous process and took a little bit longer than we anticipated, but we're there now, so that's fine. In addition, you know, throughout the course of this year, we've been expanding our capacity from effectively what was a pilot type capacity at the start of the year. We've now had to build that out to over 300,000 tonnes per annum, which includes, you know, as you'd expect, you know, substantial infrastructure improvements. You know, we've had to build some, you know, huge storage sheds and, you know, adding additional plants and all that kind of stuff, and that all took a bit of time, but again, that's all done and up and running, so that's fantastic. And alongside all of that, we've been starting to build out our sales channels. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can go to market in Brazil. And, you know, the most obvious is to go direct to the farmer through your own sales force. The other is that they have established distributor networks down there, and you know it's very common to sell these types of products through distributors. And the third is to sort of tap into the existing organic fertilizer market. So already this year we've announced a contract with a major distributor in our area to take 36,000 tons of product. We've also announced a contract with another organic fertilizer producer to take 50,000 tons of product. They plan to take our product and blend it with theirs to make a new sort of super product, if you like. And, you know, our sort of third string to our bow in terms of sales has been just developing, you know, an organic network of our own, pardon the pun, you know, through our own sales force. So we've been attacking that as hard as we can, and, you know, It's all starting to take shape.
Yeah, so you've effectively, you know, you've gone from, you know, being an explorer there to now a producer, and so you're generating cash flow, and you've announced there close to 90,000 tons. So where do you want to? I mean, I know there's I don't know how this sits, but you've applied for a mining license. Are you limited in the amount you can sell before you get this license or not?
No, not in a practical sense. I mean, we've got a 4-year trial mining license, which has 3 years left to run. So we have plenty of runway on that. And under that license, without boring everybody with the minutiae of paperwork, in a practical sense, we can sell as much as we want. But you're right, we have applied for a full mining license, and you know, the authorities have indicated to us that we should expect, you know, an adjudication on that in the coming, you know, 6 months or so. The way it works in Brazil, once to apply for a full mining license is a little bit straightforward. You have to meet some basic criteria, which we do meet, and you know, the government's very supportive of mining generally and fertiliser production. They are super supportive of. So we've got no fears whatsoever that the mining licence won't be approved. And we expect that to come through, you know, probably towards the end of this year, maybe Q1 next year. But as I say, it's certainly the least of our worries in terms of things that we're worried about. So so that'll happen in due course, no doubt.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, sales targets are concerned, like you said, there's a lot of interest there, and you're hooking up your sales channels and working. I mean, do you have targets, like, for the next 12 months of where you want to be, how many tons you want to be selling?
Yeah, we do. We certainly do, but we've also been very careful to date not to put targets into the market. I mean, one of the things that we struggle a little bit with is, you know, harvest has rapidly moved from being a, you know, sort of small cap exploration type speculative play to a more steady state business. And steady state businesses, as you know, focus on their businesses, and, you know, the share market's response to that is a little bit secondary. So we're very careful not to put forecasts into the market, because they just create, you know, speculation and opportunities for, you know, people to speculate on the stock, which is not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to create a value business built on historical performance, you know, money in the bank, dividends being paid, you know, good old fashioned, you know, earn it and then buy it type mentality, rather than trying to, you know, hype the stock up and let people get carried away.
Yeah. And as far as, you know, what you're generating at the moment, I mean, is that enough? Is that self-sustaining, or will you need to, you know, go back to the market to raise funds, or what?
Well, you know, you never say never, I guess, is obviously the answer to that. But we have no plans whatsoever to come back to the market. We've recently completed a £9.7 million placement, wherein the register was bolstered by the introduction of a number of substantial institutions, all of whom, as you would expect, a long-term value player. So they're not there for the quick flip. They're there to see the business be built out over the coming periods and see the real rewards that will be generated as the business gets re-rated as a producer rather than an explorer. So we've got plenty of money. In terms of, you know, break-even, our break-even is, you know, more or less 30,000 tonnes per annum. So it's a bit less, but just in round figures, let's call it 30,000 tonnes. So, you know, we've told the market already we've got 90,000 tonnes under contract. So, you know, that's more than break even, obviously. The job now is to process that product and to get it into the hands of our customers, and so they can on-sell it to their customers, and off we go. You know, we have a June 30 year end, and I know there's a lot of people, you know, sort of sweating on waiting to see what the accounts will say for the June 30 year end. You know, they won't disclose chunky amounts of revenue for obvious reasons, because, you know, the revenue's all being held over to this year so that we can basically start afresh. And, you know, there's no use, you know, putting, you know, small amounts of revenue into last year where it won't get proper recognition by the market and by people who are trying to understand what we're doing. So the revenue that will be recorded through the accounts won't start to be seen until the half yearly, which is 31 December.
Yeah. And this project is obviously one of a few you have. I mean, at the moment, are you still 100% focused on this, or do you have eyes on developing the other projects as well?
Yeah, we're 100% focused on this and variations of this theme. And by that, I mean, you know, one of the things that's happened over the last few months is we've seen that the opportunities for us to use this product as gateways to new markets and, you know, new territories in Brazil are more substantial than we originally envisaged. So there is still, we believe, a lot of runway to be achieved with this product. The other assets that we have, which are, you know, noteworthy, are deep traditional, you know, potash mines, and the expenditure bill to bring them through to production would be a long way off, but the bill to just bring them up the development curve is substantial. And at the moment, the best bang for buck for the company and for the company's shareholders is to continue to focus on revenue generation and you know, anything that we can do around just, you know, putting money in the bank. Those other assets are sitting there. They're not going anywhere. We can, you know, address them in the future when the time is more opportune, but it's not right now.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you've got plenty of, resources here, haven't you? Like you say, you've got, based on just 6.7% of the known mineralisation, you've got years and years and years. What support? 100 years plus production at 450,000 tonnes.
Yeah. So I don't think, certainly it'll see all of us out, that's for sure.
I was going to say, what's after 100 years? Yeah, exactly. Marvellous. Brian, one final thing for people listening right now who are not following the story but like the sound of this, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the reasons are... really as follows. So, I mean, firstly, as I said, we did a $9.7 million placement a couple of months ago at 18.5p. The stock has drifted below that a little bit. So, you know, if the big, educated, you know, smart money in town thought it was cheap at 18.5, it's certainly a bargain today at, you know, 16.5, 17. So I thought, you know, if you ever wanted to come in behind, you know, some institutions and clip an even better deal than they've managed to clip, then now's a great opportunity to cement yourself in the stock. The other second reason that I can think of is that, you know, the company has had a long history of overachieving against its objectives. You know, we've been in London now for almost 3 years. I was thinking about it this morning. You know, 3 years ago we were a $1 million company, and today we're nearly a $50 million company. And that's just, you know, been quite a rapid increase in growth, and it's been based on the team's, you know, willingness to roll their sleeves up and deliver on the promises. And the third reason is the one that I've said to you all the way through, Justin, which is, you know, Brazil is one of the largest consumers of fertilisers on the planet. Its consumption for fertilisers grows year on year. It imports almost all of its products. So we are really, you know, selling water to a thirsty man. So in terms of being in the right place at the right time with the right commodity, you couldn't think of a more perfect storm than this.
Excellent. Selling water to a thirsty man. I like that. Brian, thanks for that, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You all right, John?
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Keeping busy.
Very, very busy for August. Unexpectedly and surprisingly busy. Yeah. And lots of companies looking to grab investor attention and quite a lot of investor interest out there as well.
Yeah. Do you know what you mentioned just then before you came on? That Tesla announced they're going to be using what kind of magnets, you said?
Permanent magnets. So this in the past, Tesla have charged up magnets using the power from their batteries. But of course, in the ambition to get longer range and better efficiency out of their batteries, they're now moving to use permanent magnets, which I was surprised they didn't use in the first place. And I think they weren't using permanent magnets because they weren't sure about where they were going to get the rare earth metals from, the neodymium and the other metals that go into making permanent magnets. Other electric vehicle companies are using permanent magnets for their drive motors, and so Tesla is now moving this way in its next generation of vehicles. So I think that's a strong endorsement for the availability of rare earths going forwards, and for the importance of permanent magnets in electric vehicles in the future.
Yeah, so I'm not really over this. I don't really understand what's happening. Does this mean then they'll need rare earths in addition to the normal sort of lithium and nickel and whatever they use, cobalt, or is it instead of?
No, absolutely. It's in addition. So they're not replacing anything here. They're, if you add the neodymium into the magnet, you create a permanent magnet that is more powerful and doesn't require quite so much power to charge, if you see what I mean. So it's just a much more efficient way of doing things.
Okay. In fact, talking about rare earths, I know Makango came out with a release. Anything in that, John, you mentioned, you saw?
Well, they're updating on where they are with development programs at Songwe Hill. They're drilling at the moment. They're looking to bring assay results back at the end of August. So we're expecting reasonable information flow out of them going forwards. And that project is well supported by Noble Group. And I think it's now beginning to gain a bit of investor attention.
Yeah, cool. All right, marvellous stuff. And talking about sort of drill results, I know you cover Cora, and I've got to say I do hold some stock in Cora, so I'm always interested to see. But I thought they were looking like cracking sort of grades coming out there again, sort of underlining the potential for a standalone mine at Sanankoro. But of course, they've got other projects going on. What did you think of those results, John?
Nice grades. We're looking at 2.4 grams a ton copper. They're quite reasonable, but the really exciting bit is those grades are over long intersections, and so this is the sort of thing that makes mining much more economic. You're not chasing narrow veins for skinny bits of gold. This is going to be a bulk mining opportunity with really quite nice grades for that sort of vein thickness. And together, when you combine the grade and the thickness, the economics should look really good.
Yes, that's what I like to hear. And they've been very... John Forster, CEO, he's a very understated man, which I quite like. He doesn't oversell. And it's until someone else came on, a business development, came on and told me about these grades and how they compare initially to other drills, and he was very impressed with them. And they've been sort of, the strike length is getting longer, but they think they could have a strike length up to 14 kilometres, so it's looking more and more impressive. And there's that saying, I don't know if it's a saying, but I've got it from somewhere, that a good project just gets better and a bad one gets worse. Is that right?
I think there's a lot of truth in that. Forster is a very understated, modest, but he's also he's a diehard geologist. He's a field geologist. He's the sort of guy who likes to be out there discovering stuff and understanding and unraveling what's in the ground. And I think he knows a good project when he sees one. So this is all going in the right direction for him.
Yeah. And the thing is, when you are a CEO of a company, You've got many hats to wear. You know, one of the, like I say, he's a geologist. That's his thing. He loves that. But he also has to have the PR hat on. He has to come on the podcast. And I don't think he's a big fan of that. I think he just genuinely loves geology. And, you know, he reluctantly comes on. And he's a very nice, polite guy. But he reluctantly does the PR bit. But I don't think the, you know, if he can avoid it, he would. But he knows he has to do it as part of the CE role. But so I quite like that. Like, he's a diehard geologist, as you say. And he just loves the work. And at the moment, it looks like he's doing good work there. And he's discovering good stuff. Marvellous. Anything else you've been looking at, John, at the moment?
Well, Blue Jay is an interesting situation at the moment. Mm-hmm. We are waiting for results from the latest field season, which is ongoing in Greenland. They are drilling the mineral sands using this sonic drill rig. It's because it's so dense, you can't drill it with an ordinary rig. And it appears that the sonic drill rig itself is underestimating the real grade of this very high-grade ilmenite titanium mineral sands, and it's losing some in what some people might call or fines or slimes. And when they actually reconcile the results of the drilling with bulk sampling, they're finding the bulk samples are coming through with higher grades. And so that tells to me that there's going to be a significant resource upgrade. They've got the rig out at the Italac Delta area, which is the subject of extraordinarily high grades of the type that people haven't really seen anywhere else in the world before. And so we're looking for a 3 or 4-fold increase in those very high grades over at Italac, plus an increase in the grade and overall resource size anyway. But probably what's most exciting is they've been doing a lot of work on the feasibility study on the type of mining and the method of mining and processing that they need to use out there. And from the sounds of it, the capital cost of this project, the estimated capital cost, seems to be coming down, and the operating costs are coming down because they've figured out some more better and more efficient ways of doing things. And it's such a simple project from a mining perspective, and there's no reason why it should incur a lot of costs. So that's very exciting. Yes, it has delayed the permitting for the environmental study because you can't submit an environmental study till you've set the mining method that you're going to use, because you don't know what impact that mining is going to have till you know exactly how you're going to do it. So for me, this is all coming together. Yes, it's taken slightly longer than anticipated, but you know what? I think it's worth the wait, and I think this will look very good.
Mm-hmm. And just for people not aware of Blue Jay, can you just quickly summarise what they do, what they're hoping to do there, John?
Well, they're hoping to start mining mineral sands in Greenland in the next year or two. They're currently digging up and processing to a very basic degree bulk samples, which they're sending to off-takers. There's a lot of off-take discussion going on at the moment. And because it's such very high titanium mineral sand, which mainly goes into pigments, particularly for white paint, the sort that you buy in the B&Q, And so those discussions are ongoing, and we hope that the company will report to the market sometime soon the conclusion of negotiations and probably the financing or part financing of the project by one of these offtake groups. For example, you've got Rio Tinto with their QIT operations in Canada. They must be very keen to buy this material because it's close by and it's particularly high grade. And everybody in the world at the moment is focusing on high-grade, clean material. Again, this is very clean, very few, if any, impurities in this. And that's good from a pigment perspective. If you've got certain elements in there, the white paint can come out a bit yellow, for example, which you don't want. And because it's for particularly high grade, it means that the environmental footprint of the guys who then to do the further processing is much reduced. Their energy costs are lower, their emissions are lower. So the Chinese must be begging for this kind of material right now.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. It's J-A-Y. Marvellous. Thanks for that, John. And we'll catch up next week, fella.
Look forward to it. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You're right, Chris.
Yes, very well. Thank you very well.
Now, I'm not going to be talking about Randgold. Now, I hold a gold stock, so a tiny explorer. It's doing very well grades-wise, though, and they've got sort of big backers as well who've done very well. And I was talking to somebody else recently. In fact, Russ Mould. You know, are you aware of Russ Mould?
And yes, saying, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I know Russ, yes.
Yeah, and we're saying we're quite bullish on the gold price because not many people are at the moment. The price is down, and that's the time to look at gold, isn't it? Your gold stocks,
yeah,
I think.
Absolutely. I completely agree. It's the time to look at any asset class, let's face it. Yeah. When something's out of favour, and it's a bit rude and psychologically people are against it, absolutely it's the time to be buying. Be greedy when others are fearful, as Mr. Buffett often says. As for gold, I think, look, they're not producing any more of it, number one. Number two is it is very out of favour. I think the strong US dollar has crimped the gold price. My observation would be is that gold, the big gold defines and deposits are becoming harder to locate, to extract the gold. So I think all of that stuff is very positive for the gold price. What you need are gold companies, and you mentioned the right word a minute or two ago, they need grade. You know, grade is just the amount of gold in a ton of earth. And companies with gold deposits that have good grade and are in sort of regions, locations that are workable, if they're well financed, I think they should be all right.
Yeah. So let's look at the chart of so you said Randgold come up with some
Randgold. So Randgold, RRS. It's interesting because for me, for many, many years, Randgold's been the epitome of this sensible gold company. Very strong grade, cash on the balance sheet, mines that are expanding, you know, i.e. good production growth potential over time. And it has been a darling. You know, it's been a FTSE 100 company for a while. You know, the shares have gone up a lot if you look on a sort of a 10, 15-year basis. However, they've slipped back in recent months. They've had a poor year so far. And it's kind of interesting looking at today's numbers. All of the good stuff is still there. In terms of the cost of the gold extraction, it's still low. They're making a good margin, even at 1,200 and change gold. Production is up, and they're making good noises about their mining portfolio going forward in terms of prospectivity, new mines, extension to current mines and related. And the grade is still fantastic. So put all of that together, that's good. Why the shares been under the weather this year? Well, you know, we've mentioned gold going down a bit, but apart from that, what's been going on? One of two of their big locations, they're based centered in Western Central Africa, which, you know, is not the easiest place to operate, but they've been doing so successfully for 20 odd years. They signed a deal with the government of Mali to continue to expand their operations there. So that's a tick in the box. A bit more tricky has been the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, because there the government had been agitating for a bigger share of revenues and royalties. And this has caught up other companies as well, Glencore too, in cobalt and copper. And I think there's going to be a deal there in time, but that's kind of overhung the shares a bit. And then shorter term, in the Ivory Coast, Côte d'Ivoire, they've run into a bit of labour disputes, some strikes, which they seem to have been sorting out, judging by today's comments. Put it all together, I think the sort of the weak gold price and sort of operational challenges, shall we say, in Western Central Africa, I think has overhung the shares. But fundamentally, all of the good stuff still there. So for me today, the shares are under the cosh. You know, they've fallen now into the lower part of the 50s quid level. I would be a buyer, but I do admit the chart looks unappealing. If you're a chartist, this is probably not on your front page. For me, though, as a slightly more fundamental investor, I'm excited by Randgold shares today. I think they should be 60 quid something based on the realities and fundamentals.
Well, do you know what's good on the chart? I mean, I'm very simplified sort of take on it here, but two things. I quite like it's heading towards the 50. You know, always a round figure. I mean,
absolutely.
It doesn't matter how technical you are at charting, how adept you are. Round figures are like magnets of support levels. And so it's 53 now, and it moves quite quickly. But what I like as well is that from 2016, it had a sharp rise in price from about 40 quid up to almost, you know, $100, £100, and then it came back sharply. But that was an uptrend. That's broken down into, it consolidated for a while. It went between 55 and 70. So that's always hard. You know, buying a range or trying to trade a range is hard. You know, most traders don't even try that. They make sure there's a trend there. And so now it's in a downtrend because it's just gone below the 200-day moving. It's moving down. So that means it'll probably consolidate for a while now. But that we should be coming towards, may take a while, towards then breaking that consolidation and hopefully heading to uptrend. So at least now it's broken that, you know, it's a range and it's in some kind of trend. And that means the trend can change. If it's in a range, it's just hard work. You don't know where it's going, up or down, but it's broken down. So now hopefully it'll consolidate at some point. And I'm thinking around about 50. It won't go below, you know, definitely won't go below 40 because that was a couple of years back.
Big, absolutely.
And that was a major support level. So we're heading towards major support anyway. So I've actually just put it on a price alert here to alert me when it hits certain levels. So I'm watching it. You know, I like that. So anyway, good stuff. Anything else, Chris?
Yeah. So from the world of gold to the world of bricks, and a company called Ibstock, IBST, which is actually the UK's biggest brick producer, FTSE 250 name. This one had a little announcement last week where they said that they were doing so well in producing loads of bricks that actually they've overstepped the mark in their production facilities and they needed to put a bit more into maintenance just to make sure that they could continue producing loads of bricks. So that crimped the shares a bit last week, because what they've done is they've said, look, unfortunately, we're going to have to spend more money, you know, making sure our facilities can continue to run at full pelt, and that's going to hurt our short-term profitability. But I think it's the right thing to do. And today's numbers, which sort of build on that a bit, have sort of reiterated all those issues. Because fundamentally, what drives the brick business, what it is really, is housing demand. Now, you know, I've talked before on this podcast about how I feel that house builders are struggling. And I would still take that view. Look at the Bellway, the reaction to the Bellway numbers yesterday, for example. However, what it is with house builders, it's margin. It's not actually the amount of homes being built, because actually we have a shortage there. We need to build more homes. The issue is what price you buy them, you sell them at, and related. The thing is, the UK has a structural shortage of bricks for very many reasons. Number of brickworks shut down at the time of the last recession and related. We run a deficit in bricks, and Ibstock is one of the few companies, as I say, market leader in the UK, it can produce bricks aplenty. So I think they're in a good position, and I think they're doing the right thing in basically spending money to improve their facilities in order to keep, you know, being able to supply more bricks. So the short-term pain for long-term gain, and certainly my view would be 250p to me is a really big level on the shares. They fell below that last week. I like this one. There's a little bit of dividend yield on there. It's a sensible company doing good stuff. And I would be a buyer here sub 250. And I'm pleased to see that the reaction to today's little numbers, which really said very little beyond what was said already last week, was mildly positive. I take that as a good sign.
Yeah, well, do you know, I think I mentioned before, but I've got a sort of... So not really a friend, but my son's friend's father, we were chatting the other day at a barbecue, and he's in charge of sort of building up the foundations on most new build sites, you know, and he said, we just can't get enough bricks. We're running at capacity. We have not got the supply to keep up with demand. So you're right. I mean, the problem with the house builders is not the amount of houses they build, it's called the margins. But at the moment, like I said, they're flat out on brick production. They can't get any more, you know, so there we are. But it's sort of reflected in the chart as well. It's a strong chart, isn't it, last couple of months?
Yeah,
it's been years.
And also, it got spun out of private equity, which I know, you know, lots of stock market watchers, myself included, would be highly sceptical. But the thing is, they've come out the other end, i.e. private equity has sold their stakes, they've deleveraged and all of that sort of stuff. It's now a proper pucker, sensibly functioning company, at which you then can make a decision on how you value it. So fingers crossed, I like it here, sub 250.
Marvellous. Anything else, Chris, you're looking at?
Final one would be Cineworld. So, you know, we all like a visit to the cinema, and obviously that's come a little bit more into fashion, maybe, despite technological whatever, streaming and whatever. Sometimes the sort of the blockbuster, going to see the latest blockbuster has become, you know, come around to be an affordable bit of family entertainment and all of that sort of stuff. Cineworld's obviously a big name here in the UK and in other parts of Europe too. They made a massive splash about just under a year ago, buying a company called Regal Entertainment in the States, which basically gave them the opportunity to build a similar position in America as they have here. The difference is, though, they've had to take on a massive amount of debt, which is why if you take a look at the share price chart for Cineworld, it looks bonkers because there's a massive drop off in February when the sort of the rights issue and money raising all went through in order to finance this deal. So you've got a set of numbers now. The numbers are unbelievably messy. Loads of pro forma comments about how the business looks now with this US operation integrated. The most striking aspects are they are growing. I mean, revenue was up a pro forma 10.8%, which sounds all right. Admissions were up 4.9% to 158.9 million. So, you know, lots of people going to their cinemas and earnings were up as well. The trouble is, though, you have a bunch of debt now on this company. It's now 3.8 times net debt to EBITDA, which is a lot, and that's what worries me. So the shares I see have crept back a bit since the big money raising. I think they're just shy of £3 when I last looked today, and you know they were much closer towards £2 and a bit at the time of the money raising. So they have crept back quite nicely. The reality is, though, with this amount of debt, you know, I think it's easier just to go to the cinema and not buy the shares would be my feeling. As always, what's the killer of equity value, of share price value? It's always debt. That's always the same. When a company is highly indebted, I worry. And for this one, I'm not convinced the big US expansion will prove to be the wisest move.
Yeah, it's a bit like an anchor, isn't it, debt? And the bigger it is, you know, the more it'll drag. And I'm you're right there. I imagine if you are going to Cineworld to see a film and you hold quite a bunch of shares there, then you can't enjoy the film because you'd be worrying about the debt of the company.
I don't know the shareholder incentive programs. Maybe you get a freebie if you own enough shares. I don't know, you get a special pass or something. Who knows?
But it'd be quite good, actually. If you come to the cinema sort of you know, three times a month, you get a share or something like that. At least it boosts viewing, you know. So yeah, but like I said, you know, if you just want to go and enjoy the film, don't own the shares, because maybe just, you know, just thinking about that debt all the time and Precisely. Can't watch the film.
Well, maybe it induces you to buy that extra large popcorn or something to help boost their revenues to reduce the debt. I don't know, but so maybe it's bad at all levels.
It's not good for your health.
You spend more money and it doesn't really chew you down their debt that much.
Exactly. It's not good for your health. You're sitting there eating all the rubbish snack foods they provide, watching films a lot, not exercising a lot, but hopefully boosting the share price. But marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Chris, and we'll chat next week, fella.
Sounds a plan. See you soon.
Okay, it's time for the top five most liked RNSs on the podcast today. At five, it is Infrastrata. Last 24 hours, these are. So at five, Infrastrata. That's INFA, director shareholding, of course, the CEO, taking more of the stock. At four, Ascent Resources, permitting update. At three, Europa Metals, completion of fundraising. At two, Encondesi Energy, shareholder loan. And, of course, I was talking to Hanu on the podcast earlier. And number one, most liked RNS, came from Asia Met Resources, bankable feasibility study update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.